available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. This edition is being recorded on the 21st of January, 2026, and I'm Pete Walters. Coming up in the programme today, we're hearing about the spies who loved me, the D-Day darlings, the writer Anne Cleves, and also a new exhibition that invites audiences to look beyond an individual's sight loss to discover their strengths and talents. Plus our regular features, postbag and sport. But before all of that, we're going to this week's news with Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
An investigation has found that a series of costly accounting errors had a major role in the collapse of the charity that ran Coventry City of Culture. The mistakes by staff at Coventry City of Culture Trust, which were blamed on incompetence during internal meetings, left a £1 million hole in its budget and triggered a financial crisis that led to its demise. The trust went into administration in 2023, months after it had borrowed £1 million of public funds from the City Council to plug the gap. At the time, bosses publicly said the loan was needed for short-term funding issues. But documents released to the BBC show behind the scenes it was admitted human error and a failure of governance had caused significant problems. The Trust's former CEO, Martin Sutherland, said he was sorry for the mistakes, but argued wider pressures also contributed to the Trust entering administration. In an email, he said, "It was hard to read that the demise of the Trust continues to make an impact on individuals and organisations in Coventry and beyond. The £1 million loan was never paid back, and the Trust left £4.2 million in unpaid debts, including huge losses for a producer of the Edinburgh Fringe, the Belgrade Theatre, Culture Coventry, the Albany Theatre and Coventry University. Dozens of staff were also made redundant, and a two-year programme to boost the city's cultural scene was scrapped." One senior source involved in the trust said the events team continued spending money without knowing accounting errors had caused financial problems, while another who worked with the trust said, "I don't think at any stage anyone was operating in any way that was Machiavellian or trying to cook the books. I think it was pure financial incompetence, which is breathtaking." The Charity Commission had been investigating the Trust's collapse since 2023, but there are now calls for a statutory inquiry to establish where accountability lies. The scale of what's been uncovered and revealed in this investigation is truly shocking, Councillor Gary Ridley, leader of Coventry's Conservative group, said. "It tells a tale of incompetence. It tells a tale of chaos."
Coventry City Council will explore the possibility of introducing a tax on overnight visitors to the city, but no decision will be made without consultation, a city councillor has said. Sometimes referred to as a hotel or tourist tax, it would essentially be an additional charge paid by people staying in tourist accommodation overnight. The issue has been debated at a full meeting of the council, after the government announced in the budget that it could give some mayors and local leaders the power to introduce an overnight visitor levy. It is likely that any decision on introducing such a tax for Coventry and the wider region would need to be rubber stamped by the Mayor for the West Midlands, Richard Parker. Conservative opposition leader Gary Ridley raised concerns that it would deter people from visiting the city. But Cabinet Minister for Business at the Labour-run authority, Jim O'Boyle, accused the Conservatives of scaremongering. Councillor Ridley called on the council to rule out the implementation of a regional tourist tax, suggesting the move would amount to a Birmingham-based mayor levying a tax on Coventry, and added, there isn't even any guarantee that the revenue raised from it would actually be spent in Coventry. But Councillor O'Boyle accused the Tories of being hypocritical, pointing out that former Conservative West Midlands Mayor Andy Street had, in 2019, called for the implementation of a similar tax. Councillor O'Boyle added that he would back a grown-up approach that will see an evidence-led policy, proper consultation and local democratic accountability. He said he did not believe such a tax could be introduced before 2028, after the next mayor election, in order that there be enough time for the required consultation and relevant legislation to be passed.
A bin lorry has been destroyed after a lithium battery dumped as part of household's rubbish caught fire, a council says. During an early morning collection this month in North Warwickshire, bin workers found the fire had started in the back of their vehicle while out on a round. The damaged vehicle will cost around £250,000 to replace, or £125,000 just to fix the damage, a North Warwickshire Borough Council spokesman said. No injuries were reported, but they urged residents to properly dispose of batteries at local shops or recycling centres. Lithium batteries are used in many everyday items such as e-bikes, e-scooters, phones, laptops and vapes. However, they can start a fire without warning, and which spreads quickly, the fire service warned. Getting rid of lithium batteries in household bins was a serious risk to the council's bin workers, Councillor Margaret Bell said. And so we issue a plea to our residents. Please do not put batteries or vapes in any of our bins. As a council, we are thankful that no one was injured in this incident.
Smokers in Warwickshire are being encouraged to make 2026 their year to quit. Alongside existing support provided by Smoke Free Coventry and Warwickshire, individuals can now access stop smoking support at their GP. Warwickshire County Council is working with Integrated Primary Care to provide the service, funded through the UK government's Smoke Free Generation grant. The GP-led service is available free of charge to people aged 12 and over who live, work, study or are registered with a GP in Warwickshire. It offers a tailored 12-week programme, including one-to-one support and practical tools such as nicotine replacement therapy to help people quit smoking for good. Adults over 18 years of age may also be offered stop smoking medication and vapes where appropriate. This new route to receive support is being implemented alongside the established stop smoking service from Smoke Free Coventry and Warwickshire, which is delivered by Fitter Futures. If a GP does not yet offer the support directly, individuals will be provided support through another local practice or by Fitter Futures. Using a stop smoking service makes it three times more likely that someone will quit successfully, making the start of 2026 an ideal time to access professional support and to set a quit date. Warwickshire County Council's health spokesperson, Councillor Anne-Marie Somko, said, "It's common for people to make several attempts to quit smoking before they succeed, and we know that having the right support in place can make a real difference. With support now available through Warwickshire GPs, it's easier than ever for people to get the help they need to quit smoking for good and lead happier, healthier and more independent lives. You can visit smokefreecw.co.uk for further details."
Waiting lists at hospitals in Coventry and Rugby have fallen by thousands since the 2024 general election, according to new NHS data. Waiting lists at University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire National Health Service Trust have dropped by over 3,600 since the general election. despite record demand for NHS services in 2025. Across England, waiting lists fell by more than 86,000 in November alone, the second biggest monthly drop in 15 years. Overall, waiting lists are now down by more than 312,000 since Labour came into office. The government's elective reform plan has invested in expanded evening and weekend clinics, new and expanded community diagnostic centres and surgical hubs, and reforms to reduce unnecessary appointments by sending patients straight to a test. Taiwo Awotamai, Labour MP for Coventry North West, said, "There is no hiding the fact that UHCW Trust faced real challenges earlier in the year, with performance figures falling far short of where patients and staff would rightly want it to be. Since then, NHS workers and hospital staff at UHCW have been working incredibly hard under sustained pressure to turn things around. A fall of more than 3,600 on the waiting list since the last election is a genuinely positive step and a real credit to their dedication and professionalism. While services continue to face record demand, the figures show that progress is being made. I will continue to work closely with UHCW National Health Service leaders and local partners to make sure these improvements are sustained and that patients in Coventry see the better care they deserve." Ms. Awotamai also warned that winter pressures remain significant, with hospitals continuing to manage flu and seasonal illness, and urged anyone eligible in Coventry to take up a flu vaccination to protect themselves and others.
A homelessness support programme in Coventry is one of several across the West Midlands which is benefiting from a £1 million government cash boost. The money from the Rough Sleeping Prevention and Recovery Grant Programme is supporting around 700 people who are either already sleeping rough, are at risk of losing their home, or are living in temporary and insecure housing. The programme is backing West Midland Mayor Richard Parker's Homes for Everyone priority by funding 16 projects which help to move people into stable accommodation, manage their bills, find work or training, and access health and wellbeing services. The Mayor visited Coventry to meet a group of people who've recently been homeless but are now turning their lives around thanks to the Move On project, funded through the programme and run by housing association Citizen from the Gateway supported housing scheme. Steve, 59, from Coventry, told the Mayor how he arrived at the Gateway after being evicted from a shared house. With support from Citizen, he has overcome personal challenges and is now living independently in his own flat. He's also chairman of Gateway Link, a group of current and former Gateway residents who run social activities and use their skills to support each other, from decorating and DIY to helping with removals when they move into their own homes. Since it began last August, the project has already helped 12 residents move into their own homes, with 4 also now in work. Steve said, "Before I came to the Gateway, I was in shared accommodation, surrounded by people drinking and taking drugs, and I was becoming a project of my environment. But now I've got a far better support network than I've ever had, thanks to the Gateway. Helping others through the Gateway Link has given me a sense of purpose, direction and satisfaction in my own life. When I was asked to be the chairman, I thought, someone believes in me. Without that new self-belief, I would probably be out on the streets drinking and taking drugs." The Mayor, Mr. Parker, said, "Hearing Steve's story left me in no doubt about the devastating impact that being homeless can have on someone's life, and how a safe, secure home underpins everything. Without it, health, confidence and opportunity can quickly unravel. That's why I'm using this funding to give more people like Steve and the others I met at the Gateway the hope they need to get themselves back on their feet. It's already changed their lives for the better and now can do the same for many more."
Concerns have been raised about potential disruption to businesses and residents when the next phase of the city's very light rail is built. Coventry's VLR system has been described by the City Council as like a tram, but more flexible and affordable, as well as being an alternative to cars. There was cross-party backing at last week's full council for the latest 800-metre stretch of test track that will link the city's main railway station to Coventry University Technology Park, where the vehicles will travel alongside traffic. However, opposition councillors said they have concerns about the impact from that next phase of construction. A number said they were contacted by those living or working in the area to voice their fears. Undoubtedly, this is an asset for Coventry, says Councillor John Blundell, but I want to highlight a few issues that we think are important. There is no doubt that this will cause disruption to residents and businesses, particularly in the Park Road and Mile Lane area. My ward colleagues in Childsmore have raised concerns, and I think it is extremely important that we actually listen to what the businesses and residents say to ensure that we mitigate any disruption as far as possible. It was previously highlighted how technology meant the vehicles travelling along the new twin-track section could be driverless and an autonomous system would be more attractive to the public due to it running more frequently. A report written by the Council's Director of Innovation, Colin Light, explained that that consultation was ongoing. Conservative Councillor for Childsmore, Barbara Mosterman, said, "Apparently, consultation has taken place, but residents and businesses are telling us that the solutions offered do not address the real problems that they will face." Labour Councillor Jim O'Boyle said the disruption faced would be nothing compared to that suffered by those living near to the Midland Metro. It is important that we consult and work with residents and businesses, but the whole point of doing this is to limit the disruption, he said. So we may close part of a road for a very short period of time, but compare that to 2 or 3 years in Birmingham and the extension to the Midland Metro.
Residents in Ilsden, living close to a building which was partially demolished without planning permission, have continued to speak of their frustration over a perceived lack of action. The demolition of the former NatWest Bank in Ilsden Street, which is in the Ilsden Conservation Area, was taking place until the City Council served a temporary stop notice in January last year. The matter is currently with the Planning Inspectorate after the building's owner took it to appeal. Woodlands Councillor Gary Ridley asked the City Council if it could understand the frustration of seeing the site abandoned and asked if representations could be made to the Secretary of State to deal with it in a timely manner. The building at 34 to 36 Earlston Street was in a conservation area and permission would have been required before it was demolished. Traders, shoppers and residents have raised fears about the safety of the scaffolding and the structural stability of the adjacent buildings, as well as the demolition. On an order preventing further demolition, the City Council said unauthorised development and or demolition had been carried out. Plans for a second storey over an extension at the back of the building were approved on appeal last year, but nothing in the documents for the scheme referred to demolition work at the front. The stop notice said the building was a prominent part of the street and that planning permission had not been given for the substantial work so far. Scaffolding and hoardings currently cover the front of the site, concealing where the first floor used to be before the work started. People on social media have called the demolition disgraceful and beyond appalling, with many calling for the property to be rebuilt brick by brick.
An air ambulance service has had its busiest year in Warwickshire to date, responding to 470 emergencies across the county. Warwickshire and Northamptonshire Air Ambulance, which is operated by the Air Ambulance Service, deployed helicopters to 242 missions, while critical care cars attended a further 228 scenes. This is the largest number of incidents since records began in 2012, an increase from 453 incidents in 2023 and 465 incidents in 2024. Phil Bridle, head of operations for the Air Ambulance Service, said, "Behind every one of these missions is a person experiencing one of the most frightening moments of their life, as well as families and loved ones waiting for help to arrive." Medical emergencies accounted for the largest number of call-outs in the region last year, followed by road traffic collisions, with some incidents occurring in rural or other hard-to-reach locations. Treatments included emergency anaesthesia, blood transfusions, advanced pain relief and specialist cardiac interventions, helping to stabilise patients before transfer to hospital. Mr. Bridle added, "Our crews are trained to deliver critical care in the most challenging environments, and being able to respond to so many emergencies across Warwickshire is only possible thanks to the continued support of our local communities. The service operates 24 hours a day, every day of the year, dispatching to accidents, road traffic collisions and other major incidents." The charity said it received no government funding for its services and relies entirely on donations, fundraising and community support to remain operational.
A contestant on the latest series of the hit TV show The Traitors has been hailed for raising awareness about stammering. Jessie Stride, who is 28, introduced herself in the first episode as being on one of the biggest tests ever. For Bapinda Purwal, founder of the Coventry Stammerers Support Group, Jessie's presence on the BBC One programme has been incredibly inspiring and has helped to normalise the condition. "It really means a lot to see that representation," she told BBC CWR. "When I was growing up, I never saw stammering on TV, and if I did, it would be a joke or part of a comedy sketch." Ms. Purwell added, "Seeing Jessie on Traitors has just been so empowering. It's great that it's not the focal point of her story. It's great that people haven't asked her about it on the show as she's talking. They're just interested in her ideas, theories and game plan. So it's really powerful to see someone stammering so openly but talking about something else. When I speak in meetings at work and I'm stammering, I find that people try to finish my sentences or aren't sure what's going on. But having Jessie on The Traitors, and particularly when she told the audience that she stammered, has been great for raising awareness. Because it takes us a bit longer, in fact, when we do speak, we always have something important to say, because we've thought about it that bit more. I think that's what makes stammerers unique. Stammering might affect 8% of children and at least 1% of adults, with many people not declaring it or even realising they have the stammer."
A marble foundation stone laid 120 years ago by one of the most celebrated actresses of Victorian theatre has been rehomed in Coventry city centre. Dame Ellen Terry was born on the city's Market Street in 1847 and rose to become a stage icon with a career spanning several decades. The actress laid the foundation stone of the Empire Theatre in 1906, but when the venue closed in the 1970s, it was taken to the Criterion Theatre in Earlston, where it went on display. Following recent redevelopment at the Criterion Theatre, the stone now has been gifted to Coventry University, a spokesperson said. It will feature in a new exhibition at the University's Lanchester Library, launching on the 179th anniversary of the actress's birth on the 27th of February. The display will showcase rare items from the university's Ellen Terry collection, including prints and theatre programmes. Paul Nolan from Coventry University Archives and Special Collections said the exhibition was about returning the foundation stone to where Ellen Terry's story began. The university already has a building named after the actress, which is used as a hub for students from the College of the Arts and Society. This is about reclaiming her story, reminding the city of its cultural heritage, and highlighting the Ellen Terry Building as a unique link between the university and the performing arts, Mr. Nolan explained. Dame Ellen Terry deserves to be remembered, not just as a Victorian icon, but as a Coventry-born pioneer whose influence shaped theatre history. Keith Railton, president of the Criterion Theatre, said a wall that originally held the Ellen Terry stone at the venue had to be removed to prepare for the recent improvements. This presented a fitting opportunity to relocate the stone closer to its original site in the city centre. We are delighted that Coventry University has accepted our offer regarding its new home.
A local university is playing a leading role in an international programme designed to help improve the health of older adults worldwide through badminton. Coventry University is working closely with the Badminton World Federation on the Shuttle Time for Seniors programme, adapted from a globally successful programme for children and young people. The programme is already making a difference to people's lives in countries such as Malaysia, Singapore and South Africa, the university said. Professor Mike Duncan from the university said the Coventry-based trial benefited participation's movement as well as their mental well-being and social connection. The research shows, he said, that racket sports such as badminton are particularly well-suited to older adults because they combine multi-directional movement, decision-making, coordination with low injury risk, while also stimulating bone, joint and muscle health. This isn't about pushing people through an exercise routine. It's about moving at your own pace, together, as a group. The social element, the tea and coffee afterwards, the chat, that's just as important as the physical activity. And physical activity is one of the strongest predictors of long life and good health. Because if people lose confidence in their ability to move, they stop engaging. What we're doing here is giving people that confidence back, physically, socially and psychologically. Sahir Edu from the Badminton World Federation added, Shuttle Time has always been about using badminton as a force for good, breaking down barriers to physical activity and sport by ensuring that badminton is truly accessible to everyone. Our collaboration with Coventry University has been instrumental in extending this vision to older adults through Shuttle Time for Seniors, combining strong scientific insight with practical, community-based delivery. This programme shows how badminton can make a real difference in everyday life.
Warm-hearted residents are being urged to donate a coat to Age UK Coventry and Warwickshire. As part of the charity's Winter Health campaign, it is calling on the local community to donate winter warmer items to help older people stay warm during the colder months. Colder weather can make it harder for older people to get out and about, increasing feelings of loneliness and impacting health and well-being. Spending more time at home also leads to higher energy bills and, combined with the cost of living crisis, places extra pressure on those already struggling. An estimated 1.9 million older people across the UK will face this winter in poverty. Age UK Coventry and Warwickshire spokesperson Caljit Madahar said, It's a crisis hiding in plain sight. As costs rise and temperatures fall, many older people are facing winter in the cold. Your donation of a winter warmer item can make an immediate difference to someone in need.
Outlook News.
Thanks very much to our readers, Peter and Elaine. Every time I hear something about the collapse of the Culture Trust, it just makes me so angry. What a disaster. Anyway, let's move on. Lighting up times before we do move on this week are 4:34 p.m. to 8:02 a.m. And next up, of course, here is Hugh with what's happening at Vision Hub this week.
Thank you very much. You know, buses, they're like buses. You wait for ages for one to come along, and then two do. We have just bought a second new bus. So this one is an old bus, but it's newer than the old bus. This could get very complicated very quickly. The Enterprise Club had a bus that they were offloading, which we have managed to acquire. So that the little Renault that we've had for 10 years, can you believe, and we were only going to keep it for 4, and we thought that was a bit of a stretch. We didn't know it was going to last, didn't think it would last that long, but we've had it for 10 years. We've actually managed to sell, which is just fantastic news, and you know, for rather more money than I thought we were going to get for it, but there we are, which is absolutely great. Let's offset some of the money that we've had to pay out for this other bus, which is also a fairly small Renault. In fact, the only thing that you will feel differently is that it doesn't rattle as much. So this is a 2016 bus as opposed to a 2008 bus. It's a 10-year-old bus as opposed to an 18-year-old bus, and you can tell. But everything else, it will feel very, very similar. Of course, the Citroen is the new big bus that's out on the road and doing everything splendidly. What's going to happen is we're a 3-bus charity now, and we'll remain a 3-bus charity, which is fantastic. But we're going to just go back to 2 buses for a little bit every now and again, because, you know, buses need to be repaired and what have you. So, you know, it'll be fine. We'll try to avoid Mondays and Tuesdays. We needed to use all 3 buses on Monday, very much so. So, but that was good. You know, it was nice to be able to have a few shorter journeys and more people coming in comfort. So we're going to, for this newer bus, we're going to send that off to get its livery done. So we'll have the new logo and what have you on it, and then when we get that back, we're going to send the middle bus off to it's had a few dings and dents in its recent times. We're going to get that in new livery as well, and just make sure that it's in tip-top working condition. Every now and again, say, we have to send our buses away to get checked over, make sure they're running carefully. So we'll now, hopefully, you know, if one breaks down or have to go and do that, then we'll be okay. Now, we had a little thought in the staff meeting yesterday. We thought we've got 3 buses, and we just used their, as you say, like the old bus, the old, you know, the middle-aged bus and the new bus or whatever, and we were getting a bit bored of that. So we thought, here we are, here's an idea. Everybody out there in listener land, we want you to come up with names for the buses. So we've got 3 buses, one small, one's medium, one's large. Look, and I'll give you my suggestion, but this is not going to win. I thought, you know, for the little bus, we'd call it Mini, you know, and for the big bus, we'd call it Maxi. And then I thought for the middle, for the one in, you know, the other one, we'd call it Bette Midler, you know, right in the middle. You know, so, but anyway, that was my idea, but anyway, it's not going to win. Anybody who comes up with Bussy McBusface can take a hike, but you know, we might come up with a small prize for the people who come up with the best names.
A free ride?
Nah,
just once.
Yeah. We might have might be a box of chocolates or a bottle of something. Anyway, so out there in listener land, come up with new names for our buses, and if we like them enough, we'll give you a prize, and we'll get them stuck on. I think get the names stuck on the sides of the buses discreetly. Okay, things coming up. We've got no exercise class next week, so that's the Wednesday exercise class run by Sophie. So it's 28th of January. If you're normally come to that, don't come to it. Couple of things looking ahead. Now, Sam Young, who you remember ran the London Marathon for us last year, is running the London Marathon for us again this year, which is absolutely fantastic. So that takes place on the 26th of April. We will launch the fundraising portal, I think, very soon, if it's not already up there. But, you know, if you want to support Sam, there are plenty of ways to do so, and you can obviously give money as well at the at reception. On that same day, the 26th of April, Chris and Claire are doing the Coventry Way again. Now, they're not doing it for sponsorship this time, because they just wanted to have a little less pressure on them. But if you do fancy donating, you know, to support them anyway, then we're always happy to accept such donations. So that's Sam Young, who many of you may not know, is the husband of one of our trustees, Helen. For the London Marathon on the 26th of April, and then Chris and Claire doing the Coventry Way also on the 26th of April. 40 miles walking all around the city. Now, today was a rainy day, and the walking club decided very sensibly not to go out in the rain. We didn't manage to stop everybody coming, but I think everybody quite enjoyed the games. And actually, Games and Coffee Club has been something that's been brewing under the surface as a general idea for some time. I know several people have mentioned it to Chris. So if you are interested in perhaps a Games and Coffee Club or Tea Club that, you know, we were thinking about Friday afternoons possibly, but yet to be decided, and it does depend on best availability of space and bus, then do get in touch and let Chris know. So register your interest for one that's Games and Coffee. I have to think of a better name than that as well. But Gamey McGameface also will not do. and then finally, looking a lot further ahead, on the 9th of May, we're hoping, you remember last year we had the big music event down in Willen Hall, and that was an absolutely fantastic event. We raised a lot of money there. The chap who organised that is organising, hopefully, another one for the 9th of May. Unfortunately, he's been a bit ill, so it's a little bit dicky whether it happens or not at the moment. So, but the 9th of May, just keep that date free, and it would be a great night out with tribute acts and what have you, as well as great raffles and other entertainments, I am sure. So there we are. Probably a raffle as well, I should imagine. Okay, and I think that is it for this week.
Thank you very much, Hugh. So, listeners, get your thinking caps on. Next up, Sarah with this week's sport, and she's been looking at the physical challenges facing the world's leading tennis players in Australia. And she says, gosh, I don't fancy playing tennis at 31 degrees in direct sun. Not that I play very often, anyway.
Well, hello there, lovely, lovely listeners, and welcome to Sarah with Sport. Yes, I haven't fallen down any stairs recently. Well, I can't go up them at the moment. So, starting off, as usual, with football. Now, yesterday, I think it's true to say, most City fans woke up with a sort of nervous, cautious excitement, because it was the match of the season, the one which we all look to see when it is, when the fixture lists come out. Coventry versus the Leicester at the Coventry Building Society in Arena. So why were we nervous? I mean, we were still top of the league. Well, yes, but our recent run of form has not been that good, having won two, drawn to and lost to over the Christmas period. Plus, our lead had been cut to 3 points by virtue of Middlesbrough playing on the Friday night and beating West Brom 3-2. So, cue the match. Well, actually, before I talk about the match itself, it was great to see two of our players who'd been off for several weeks, at least starting on the bench. Those being Victor Thorpe, who'd had an injured calf, and Brandon Thomas-Asante, who'd had 10 weeks off with an injured hamstring. So that in itself was a nice fillip for the rest of the team. So I thought I'd run the risk of the curse. You see, I believe I have this curse. Whenever I watch a City match on telly, they lose. Anyway, I decided to watch the first half on Sky. Well, I say the first half. I actually watched about the first 12 minutes because Leicester scored after 10 minutes and were well on top. You just knew what was going to happen. This was going to be a runaway to the Leicester. So, television turned off. I did keep asking Alexa and Siri what the latest score was. And I was delighted to see that by half time, it was still Coventry nil, but Leicester hadn't scored again. So it was 0-1. So I braved it into my usual radio listening spot for the second half, which is sitting on the floor in the front room with my back pressed against the radiator. And given that I have broken bones in my hip, that was not going to be the most comfortable thing. So I sat on a cushion. Well, it worked. Anyway, listening on the radio worked. The curse was lifted because 2 minutes into the second half, Redoni passed to Ellis Sims, who scored. For Ellis, that was his 11th goal of the season. And if you remember, a few weeks ago, I was describing him as the striker who'd lost his confidence to score. Well, Frank has certainly helped him turn that round. Then I would say for the most of the second half, City were on top. In fact, to me, they had two clear penalty shouts disallowed by the ref, who was letting a lot of things go. But I think when it comes to having two of your best players brought down in the 6-yard box, that should have been penalties. That can't be waved away. But waved them away he did. But then on the 85th minute, Tak Sakamoto, or Tak Sak as I now call him, shot a beautiful ball goalwards to be tapped in very delicately by Hadji Wright, who had broken his goal deficit, which had lasted since the beginning of October. So that was a double victory, really, for Coventry. 2-1. But then there were 6 minutes extra time awarded. And when Leicester got a free kick in almost the final one of those, I sat in the front room on my cushion with my head in my hands between my knees. It's a nice trick, but don't do it at home unless you're flexible. So that was how it ended. 2-1 to Coventry. So we got our 6-point lead at the top back, and we're top of that league. Now our next match is actually Tuesday night when we're at home to Millwall, but as this won't be going out until Wednesday at the earliest, I'll have to summarise any highlights for you next week. Now next weekend match is actually on the Monday night, that is Monday the 26th. It's an 8 p.m. kickoff away to Norwich. So I would thoroughly recommend, as I always do, BBC CWR, because Rob and Steve are fantastic, the commentators. So looking at our lower league clubs, down in tier 6, Leamington were away to the leaders, South Shields, but I'm afraid they were thumped 3-0, really cementing their position at the bottom of their league. In fact, they look to be joining Stratford down in Tier 7 next season. And Stratford were also away and also lost, but this time only 1-0. Oh, and before I finish on football, a huge congratulations to my little Coventry United, who for the first time ever in their history have made it into the sixth round of the FA Vars. Slow down, guys, or you'll be off to Wembley. Now, there's no local rugby to bring you because, as I mentioned last week, Coventry is still on their break and will resume next Saturday, that's the 24th, with a match against Bedford. So one other piece of sport I would like to mention is the Australian Open tennis. You know me and my tennis, I do love it, and I've really got into it since I've been reporting on it for you. Well, it's held in Melbourne. It will last about 2 weeks. And I think actually the reason I can't get into the Australian like I do with Wimbledon, the French and the US is the time difference. The only good thing is because of the heat at the moment there, they are playing quite a few of the matches 7 a.m. till about 12 p.m. So they're bearable, though listening to sport in the morning is not really my yen. Anyway, so today, oh yeah, talking about the temperatures, next week they're averaging in the day 31 degrees with sun. Yes, it's going to be very hot there. So we've had day one today because I'm recording this on the Sunday, and all three Britons have played, and three Britons are through. I mean, they won't be by the time you're listening to this, they'll be out, but isn't that great? So we've got Emma Raducanu, Cameron Norrie and Arthur Ferry. Arthur who, you say? Yes. Well, he is a relative unknown, ranked outside the top 100, made it through the qualifying rounds, and today he won in straight sets and made it through to the second round. So, I'll bring you more news on what happens next week. But my betting is it will be Elena Sabalenko who wins the women's and Carlos Alcaraz who wins the men's. But what do I know? And finally, sticking with tennis and actually the Australian Open, it seems to be the thing nowadays that to attract a wider audience, the big tennis competitions hold sort of quirky competitions before the main one. You may remember in the US they had the mixed doubles competition. So there were two that particularly caught my eye here. The one was the $1 million one point. Mm-hmm. This featured an amateur player taking on one of the world's top ranking players, but only playing one point. Who got to serve that point? They tossed for it. And the winner of the $1 million was an amateur who managed somehow to take one point off the world number one, Jannik Sinner. Nice money if you can make it that quickly. But the competition that really caught my attention was the gender match. This was basically a rerun of the famous match where Billie Jean King beat her male competitor. And in this competition, we saw Elena Sabalenko, the 27-year-old Belarusian and world number one, take on Nick Kyrgios. Kyrgios, shall we say, is an interesting character and can be quite a hothead. He's an Australian. I don't know his age at the moment. Anyway, it was 4-4 in the first set, and then Elena just sort of took off. She won the next 5 consecutively and polished off both sets inside 79 minutes. Well done, Elena. I wonder what quirky competition they'll have at Wimbledon. I know, they'll allow players to play in any colour. No, don't be silly, Sarah. This is Britain and Wimbledon. Anyway, folks, that has been your sport this week, and I do hope so much to be talking to you next week. Have a lovely, lovely week, everyone. Bye! Oh, and before I finish on football, a huge congratulations to my little Coventry United, who for the first time ever in their history have made it into the 6th round of the FA Vars. Slow down, guys, or you'll be off to Wembley.
Thanks to Sarah for the sport. Here's Dave Monks with Postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello and welcome to your Postbag. Outlook is 50 years old this year on September the 16th. Have you any thoughts about that? And how should we celebrate it? Our eldest son, Paul, works for the BBC, and being disabled himself, he has joined the Disability Forum. On the panel was blind comedian Chris McCausland. Paul told him that his dad helps with a talking newspaper and presents a listener two-way feedback spot. And what does Chris think of talking newspapers? Chris's reply was quite long-winded, but the gist was that talking newspapers were all right for older people that haven't got to grips with the new technology. The younger people can go on to the new technology. So what do you think? Will there be a need for talking newspapers in the years to come? And what about the two-way communication aspect of Outlook? Postbag, that I've put my heart into trying to keep going for over 40 years, and thank you for helping with that. And thing is about looking up things on the phone, on the new technology, is that you may not get those personal tips that you get in Postbag. The things that you didn't know, but didn't know you didn't know. Like the ones that Edwina gives you. Here she is.
Hi, everybody. It's Edwina. Everybody at the moment, with it being Christmas, will be carrying their dinner on a plate, on a tray, to sit and watch television at the same time, possibly. Sometimes it's a good idea to put a tea towel over the tray so that your dinner plate doesn't slide. I just thought it would help, as there will be more people wanting to watch telly. I hope your Christmas goes great. Bye.
Thank you, Edwina. It's so nice to hear from Edwina again, don't you think so? Because I go around and record them, because she can't record them herself. And it's so nice to hear from Linda Wiltshire. Linda Wiltshire has sent me an email to David Monks linda46@gmail.com. Linda writes, "Hi David, I am glad that Graham Whale is enjoying the DCI Ryan books written by L.J. Ross, because I enjoy them as well. They are a bit gory in places, as most murder mystery books are. He may like to know that to date, she has written 22 DCI Ryan books. 9 of the books are available from R&IB Talking Books Library, and all 22 can be downloaded from Audible Books. Best wishes, Linda Wiltshire." Well, thank you so much, Linda. It's so nice for a fellow listener to get some feedback, so that should please Graham Whale. That's what Postbag's all about. So please send us another message soon. So what did you do over the Christmas period? Let us know. Well, Elizabeth went to the Christmas market in the Coventry precinct, but on the way there, she visited the museum with a giant dinosaur, a Diplodocus, on loan from the National History Museum, London. Here's Elizabeth.
Hi everyone. The Roving Report this week is an educational visit to the Herbert Art Gallery and Museum. This was quite engrossing. I saw Dippy the dinosaur, and I was very interested in the section on the Blitz of Coventry in November 1940. My father, who was a founder of the Coventry Art Guild, went into town the night of the Blitz and sketched the scene of the tragedy. His oil painting captured the smoke rising from the ruins. The painting was consequently on exhibition in Coventry and Birmingham in the 1940s. We also visited the German Christmas market in Broadgate too. Lovely. The afternoon was rounded off nicely with a hearty steak and ale pie in the Flying Standard.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's great to hear your reports. It really is. And now Doreen has a New Year greeting for you.
Hello, everybody. It's Doreen Hilton speaking to you all again, which I said you will be hearing from me soon, very shortly. Now we're into the new year. I have my Dave. He's just rang me, God bless him, with a little chat before we do this speech over the CBS, as we always do. Very nice of him. He's had a good Christmas, so have I, and a good 80th birthday last year. But now, as we're into the new year, I'd like to wish you all a very, very happy new year. As for happy new year, sometimes it's a healthy new year, and keep your spirits up for the new year, because that's what we want. So I wish you all the very best, the staff, the volunteers in the centre that do all that hard work for us. I hope all of us and all our listeners too have a very good year this year, and can't wait till the summer comes with all the sunshine again. So I wish you all the best. Doreen Hilton, signing off. Bye.
Thank you, Doreen. It's so nice to have these conversations with you, and may I wish you a very happy new year. Now, I went to a sing-around at the Humber pub recently that our eldest son Paul goes to. Singer Keith Donnelly, who duets with Lauren South and who has written jokes for Phil Cool and Jasper Carrot, sang a song he'd written about us all having a free ride round the sun. That's a nice thought. Let's enjoy our free ride round the sun. Just make the most of it. Incidentally, it will be my 80th trip round the sun, my 80th birthday party at Paul's Folk Club, the Tump at the Humber Pub, on Thursday the 14th of May 2026. Please let me know if you're interested in going along. And also, we will hear from Elizabeth soon about a film she went to see called Song Song Blue. It's about a couple who did a sort of tribute act to Neil Diamond. And it's a really good film, actually. So if it's not too late, you might like to go along to that. So may I wish you a very happy and peaceful New Year. And especially, I wish you peace of mind. Thank you very much. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's it from Postbag this week. Keep your contributions coming. Our Warwickshire Wandering this week takes us to the village of Preston-on-Stour, south of Stratford. Originally in Gloucestershire, the village was transferred into Warwickshire in 1931 and boasts a link with the legendary children's television show Teletubbies, which counted as its home Wimpstone, just a mile away.
Preston appears in most of the guidebooks on Warwickshire, and words like idyllic, tranquil, picturesque, quiet backwater are always quoted and absolutely true. But Preston is more than that. It is a living community and has not yet become just a commuter village, but it might have by now. It is part of Olscott Estate and has been in the West family since 1749. Even today, most houses and much of the surrounding countryside belong to the present owner, Mrs. Holman West. The village has a population of just over 100, and a varied cross-section of people live there. Farmers, farm workers, local craftsmen, past and present employees of the estate, as well as a smattering of teachers, civil servants, solicitors, retired folk, and young mothers. Preston is said to derive its name from Priest Town, and Olscott Park, the West family net mansion, is built on the foundations of an ancient monastery belonging to Deerhurst Priory. The oldest house in the village, whose angle completely defies gravity, is still called the Priest's House, and was said to have been used by the monks conducting services in the Church of St. Mary. Taking the turn to Preston, after pressing the Stour, and you find yourself in the street, with its neat Victorian brick houses on either side. Quite a model village in the early 1850s when they were rebuilt. Each has its own outhouse, or as it was called, brew house, and pigsty at the back, and a yew tree by the front gate. This old tradition is rarely seen these days, and so Preston is rightly proud of its yew trees, a symbol of immortal life. At the end of the street is the village green, with the Church of St. Mary on one side and Locke's Farm on the other. The latter is a marvellous old half-timbered farmhouse and is just one of the many lovely old buildings that make up the village. Indeed, by 2020, there had still only been three new houses built in Preston since 1852. From the green, there are two loop roads. The top one leads up past the old thatch to Park Farm. The bottom one past labourers' cottages and the dell to Lower Farm. Both farms are very important in the working life of the village, and their activities a constant source of interest throughout the year. A very old tradition carried out in Preston is the Harvest Supper, held in October at the village hall. This dates back to the time when much of the stock had to be killed before the winter months, and today it is still very much a meat meal. Between 80 and 90 villagers sit down at two long candle-lit trestles to plates of cold turkey, ham and beef, and really enjoy an old-fashioned harvest supper with their neighbours.
The village hall was formerly the coronation hall, built by the villagers in 1953, and was replaced in 1999 by a splendid brick-built hall renamed the Three Parishes Millennium Hall. One of the most delightful things about these village functions is the age range of those attending. From the very old to the very young, all join in. Talking to older members of the village, Preston has certainly changed over the years. For instance, in the 1920s, Olscott Estate used to employ 30 villagers working in the park, gardens and farmland. But now that number is drastically reduced. There is no doubt that, like most rural communities, Preston is changing.
Losing your sight doesn't mean you have nothing to offer to the wider world. Margaret reports on a new exhibition, Scene, that invites audiences through a series of portraits to look beyond an individual's sight loss to discover their strengths and talents. This is part two of her feature.
Clive Jones, British archery champion. Blind veteran Clive Jones, 51, from Market Drayton in Shropshire, lost his sight completely in 2000 after being assaulted while serving in the army. He took up archery in 2001 during rehabilitation at St Dunstan's, a charity supporting blinded veterans, now known as Blind Veterans UK, and quickly became a talent. Now he represents Great Britain internationally and secured a silver medal for Great Britain at the IBSA World Games. Currently ranked number 4 in the world in his category, Clive hopes that blind archery will feature in the Paralympics at the 2028 Los Angeles Games. It really is a lovely sport. It's inclusive, he says. It doesn't matter if you've got no eyes, no arms, no legs. You can still shoot an arrow. You're totally blind. All you see is black. You've just shot a bow and arrow, and quite frankly, next thing you hear is the arrow hitting the target. That's a great feeling. Clive shoots by using a tactile sight attached to a tripod, which touches the back of his hand. A spotter tells him where the arrow landed. Joshua says, maybe it's because Clive is Welsh too, but we had a great laugh during the shoot. He is a fun-loving guy. Ben Breen, gamer. Video games have always been a part of Ben Breen's life after he was born without sight. The 31-year-old from Kent started off playing games on his PC without any of the technology that may have helped him understand them. Since then, developers have added more features to improve the gaming experience for visually impaired people. An accessible games and immersive technologies research officer with RNIB, Ben now shares his experiences with the gaming industry to help them introduce helpful features for users with little or no vision. This could be extra screen narration or lock-on aim in fighting games. I started out with games like Fighter Pilot on PC, not really understanding how anything worked because I didn't know about the tech, says Ben. We've had games released on a couple of platforms that are fully playable, but we need to see all the companies stepping up. Sight loss is a spectrum and gaming can still happen, but more needs to be done in terms of making games accessible. Joshua says, I shot Ben in his bedroom and found him fascinating. How fast he is and how quickly he responds to noise and his passion for gaming. Jessica Inaba, barrister. Born in Lewisham, South London, and of Congolese heritage, Jessica Inaba is renowned for being the UK's first black and blind barrister. She navigated significant challenges, completing her legal studies entirely in Braille and passing the bar at just 23. Now she works in an alternative dispute resolution, employment, family, housing, immigration and international law, while also dedicating her time to making the legal profession more accessible. Jessica is the founder of Real Eye Station, an initiative that promotes accessibility and inclusion through workshops in Braille education, and is currently working on her third novel. My heritage and lived experience with disability have given me a deep understanding of the barriers marginalised communities face, she says. The law is a powerful tool for change, and I wanted to be part of that change. Joshua says, Jessica was my favourite to photograph because of the ceremonial garb, wig and gown. I shot her in the Middle Temple. She looked so striking. The image reflects her power and success. Louise Simpson, marathon runner. Runner Louise Simpson became the first blind woman in the UK to join the exclusive 100 Club of marathons. The 41-year-old from Sheffield ran her first marathon in 2018 and competes with a guide. She has a condition called retinopathy of prematurity, which is believed to be caused by being given too much oxygen at birth. Playing sport from an early age, Louise entered swimming and athletics competitions at New College Worcester, where she also started playing the sport of goalball, competing for Team GB. I discovered my love of running in 2008 when a friend training for the British 10K in aid of Guide Dogs for the Blind asked me to join him, says Louisa. It's the first time I considered running, but I caught the bug and haven't stopped since. Joshua says, Louise was the first person in the exhibition to pose for me. She reached out to me, and I'm so grateful to her for helping get it off the ground.
The writer Anne Cleves is the focus of attention from Coventry Telegraph reporter Hannah Stevenson in Bookshop. If you read any of her books, you might like to get in touch with Dave Monks on Postbag to let us know your favourite. Elaine has the story.
Does she? We may be seeing Ashley Jensen and Alison O'Donnell on our screens in the 10th season of BBC One Shetland, but author Anne Cleves has not finished with her original fictional cop, D.I. Jimmy Perez, played by Douglas Henschel in the first 7 series. The best-selling author and inspiration behind Shetland and Vera has moved Jimmy from Shetland to Orkney, where he is living with his fellow police officer partner Willow and their child. And together they've become a crime-solving duo in her new novel, The Killing Stones. It was going to be a standalone, but all my series started off as standalones, and I really enjoyed writing it. I can't wait to go back to Orkney too, which is a very special place, says the best-selling award-winning author. It's much gentler than Shetland. It's more green, fertile. In a sense, it's more Scottish. Her last Shetland novel, Wildfire, was published in 2018, when Jimmy was moving to Orkney with Willow. So why has Anne decided to bring him back? I thought, that's the end. I don't need to write any more about him. But then I get a kind of longing to go north again, because I do love the islands. So it's about place, really, and exploring how Jimmy might fit into a new environment, and how his setting up home with Willow and their son might mellow him a bit, make him easier, happier. Anne, who at 71 has enjoyed phenomenal success with her TV adaptations of her book series, featuring Vera Stanhope, Shetland, and Matthew Venn, had a slow burn to publishing stardom. I was 20 years without any commercial success, she recalled. The books went into libraries and the occasional indie bookshop, but certainly you wouldn't have seen it on a Waterstone shelf. So it had to be fun, It didn't need to feel like work. It was what I wanted to do for myself when I wanted my own time and space. It was only after a TV producer, who coincidentally was looking for a new female detective to fill a Sunday night slot, discovered a copy of one of her Vera Stanhope novels in a charity shop, that her career took off. Anne has always loved isolated settings. She lives in Whitley Bay, North Tyneside, close to her two daughters and seven grandchildren, but has a long connection with both Shetland and Orkney, having worked at the Bird Observatory on Fair Isle years ago with an Orcadian who she kept in touch with. She returned to Orkney for research, and many of the places she visited appear in the book. I love these isolated places. I like being next to the sea. I get a bit claustrophobic if I'm inland. I feel safer somehow on the edge. I like small communities. I've never lived in a city, apart from about 6 months in my gap year doing voluntary service in London, and I couldn't get along with that. After dropping out of university, she took a job as an assistant cook at the Fair Isle Bird Observatory, where she fell in love with the wilds of Scotland and met her husband, ornithologist Tim Cleeves. Anne, now author of 37 critically acclaimed novels, translated into more than 20 languages, who was awarded the prestigious Crime Writers Association Diamond Dagger in 2017, says that the only involvement she has had with any of the TV adaptations was to take the producers and script writers to the settings of her books. But she doubts if her crime-fighting duo will become another TV adaptation. I didn't write it in the hopes that Dougie would come back. I wrote it because I wanted to write that story. I love the new Shetland series on the television. If you think about it, the hero of that show was always the landscape. And having Ashley Jensen and Alison O'Donnell, who plays Tosh, just works really well. I love those two women together. So it was nothing to do with the television at all. I just wanted to go north again and explore what was happening in Jimmy's life. In the new book, Jimmy investigates the murder of his close childhood friend Archie Stout, killed with a Neolithic stone bearing ancient inscriptions. Her famous detective has changed, Anne agrees. As he investigates, he finds out that Archie wasn't quite the great hero he thought he was when he was growing up. He realises he'd actually suspected that Archie was flawed too, but hadn't wanted to recognise it. She keeps in touch with award-winning Vera star Brenda Blethyn, and they catch up at book events, but says her life has been much the same since the series ended in January, after a 14-year run. I used to love going on the Vera set, but watching filming is quite boring, because it's the same take over and over again. I went really to catch up with the cast and crew and would have lunch with Brenda. I'm going to write one more Vera novel. She's retired on television, but not in the books. I'll certainly think about retiring Vera in this last book, but if I want to come back to Northumberland, I would probably write from the perspective of the new female character I introduced called Rosie Bell. But she won't kill Vera off in the last novel, she says. I think it would confuse readers dreadfully if suddenly she died when she was still alive on the screen. While she might once have considered moving to Orkney, Anne's husband died suddenly in 2017. And understandably, she wants to remain near her family in the North East. It's great to have that company all around me. She says her friends also helped her cope after her husband's death. When he died, after we'd done the funeral, the girls and I ran away down to North Devon, which is a place where I grew up, and stayed with a very old school friend and walked a lot. It was February, quite wet and windy,
and that's really where the Matthew Venn books came from. Writing helped her in her grief. "Writing has always been an escape for me," she said. "It is a joy. I wake up in the morning and think, what story am I going to tell today?" She still gets up at 6 a.m. most mornings, because that's when her brain works better, she says, and has lived in the same house for 20 years. "We moved in before I had any real success, and I still have a lot of the same neighbours. It's not at all grand. It's just part of a nice little street, and we look after each other here." Never still for long, Anne is currently working on another Matthew Venn story, and thinks the Jimmy and Willow crime-fighting partnership will become a book series. Away from writing, you'll find Anne walking in the Northumberland Hills, having fun with her family, or visiting those beautifully isolated havens further north. "I don't feel any different in myself," she says, "of getting older. I was back in Fair Isle a few weeks ago, where it all started 50 years ago. Walking down the island and catching up with the islanders, I didn't feel any different from that 20-year-old.
From an early age, Alistair Wood knew that his family was different, and now, 50 years later, he's written about them. This is part one of the remarkable Spies Who Loved Me story, read by Bill.
As a child, Alistair Wood had been aware that there was something unusual about his parents. In a small attic space above the garage of their family home in Woking, Surrey, he and his brother found shotguns hidden under the lagging. His mother showed him the cyanide pill she hid in her underwear drawer. And, while digging a vegetable patch in the back garden, he found buried radio parts. Alistair's father had left when he was just a baby, but when he was 13, the family went to live in a secret intelligence service training camp, which is where he spent his formative years. However, amid a culture of secrecy and subterfuge, it took Alistair years to piece together his parents' startling stories of SIS spycraft. "And when something's not talked about, it makes you more curious," he says. John Brian Wood, or JBW, as even Alistair called his father at their occasional out-of-the-blue meetings, spent the Second World War tracking Nazi agents in Argentina. During the Cold War, he was integral to MI6's secret project to dig a tunnel beneath Berlin for the interception of KGB communication. It was also in Berlin that he met Alistair's mother, Margaret Miller, an SIS secretary. She was dispatched into enemy territory, on one occasion acting as a double for a spy whose cover had been blown, and on another assessing sites for excavating the top-secret tunnel. Then, in 1956, a mole leaked to the existence of the Berlin Tunnel to the Soviets, which sparked fears that JBW was a double agent. JBW was also spotted entering the KGB office in Helsinki. So he was duly ejected from the SIS under the guise of resignation, although it was George Blake who was later unmasked as the KGB mole. He was booted out of SIS quite rightly, but on a technicality, says Alistair. He was innocent of the reason why they booted him out. This injustice is partly why Alistair, a 66-year-old retiree who worked in advertising, has undertaken the mission of telling his family's story in his new book, My Family and Other Spies. But it proved tricky because so much information about his parents' careers remains classified. Alistair's stepfather once called JBW bizarrely intelligent, and Alistair says, "I think it was too much for most people. But he did some fantastically stupid things, like wandering into the KGB headquarters in Helsinki. How he got out of there alive is a mystery. But JBW believed in Sufism, a form of Islamic mysticism, and he thought that he would have a premonition of any imminent danger. He also claimed he had been acting on voices from God. He didn't have a bone in his body that seemed to show any fear. I don't think it's bravery. It's more this bizarre spiritual belief that nothing bad will happen, says Alistair. Sufism perhaps explains his father's approach to family life too. The key to it for me, that I saw repeated in several letters, is that Sufi has no home, no family, no country, says Alistair. He was this free wandering spirit. His long-suffering wives and children had learned this the hard way. Alistair had been a baby when JBW left Margaret a note saying, "We're just going out for a loaf of bread. We might be a while," taking Alistair's brother Jonathan, then 3, with him. They were indeed gone for a while, since they sailed to Canada to join JBW's next wife. No one is sure if he had 4 or 5 wives. He took Margaret's passport to stop her following them, but she was undaunted, securing a replacement and setting off for Quebec in JBW's wake. She located Jonathan's nursery, followed him and the nanny home, broke into the house and reclaimed him. You can't but help admire the fact that she stopped off for a skiing trip en route back to Woking. But she also ensured her sons were made wards of court to stop JBW absconding with them again. After leaving SIS, JBW was signed up by the United Nations and posted to far-flung destinations, including Vietnam, Malawi, and Iraq. He died aged 81 in a car crash in Bosnia, and it speaks volumes about how elusive he was that his gravestone bears incorrect dates.
The D-Day darlings, Emily and her mum, musical singer Elizabeth, came to perform at the Monday Club, and Dave Monks was on hand to interview them.
One Monday morning in November, 2 Polish performers came to entertain at the Monday Club. One was Emily, a member of the D-Day Darlings, and her mum, Elizabeth, who sings in musicals. I first spoke to Emily and asked her what she's been doing at this busy time of the year for the D-Day Darlings.
Yeah, so November's been a really busy month for the D-Day Darlings. We've had lots of remembrance events and shows. It's really been wonderful. We've performed all over the country, and we've had some nice little moments on television as well. We performed on Good Morning Britain. We went on there with a lovely man, Alec Penstone, who's a D-Day veteran, and he's just wonderful. And he did an interview on Good Morning Britain, and we did a little performance and sat with him and had a bit of a chat with Kate Garraway and Adil Ray, which was lovely. And we also did Love Your Weekend with Alan Titchmarsh. That actually aired on Remembrance Sunday, and we did a performance of We'll Meet Again. But one of the real highlights of that was when we went to film it, we had the opportunity, of course, to meet Alan, who was lovely, very welcoming and kind. But also on the show was Petula Clark, who's a massive inspiration to me, an amazing singer. She's had such a long, successful career in the arts, and yeah, though that was a wow moment for all of us, really. And we went to see her, and we'd already done our filming, so we were introduced to her, and then we did our performance for her, and she was singing along a little bit. So, you know, now I can actually say I've done some singing with Petula Clark. So, yeah, that was a bit of a, you know, it was unexpected. Yeah. We didn't know that would happen, and that was really the highlight of the day for all of us. So.
Wow.
Wow, you also did there was a two-course meal on the Armistice Day at the lake at Barston, and you and another D-Day darling performed.
Jessica. Yes,
yeah.
We did.
Great.
So
that's
at the Midlands Golf Club, lake at Barston, and we've done that now for a few years, and it always tends to be myself and darling Jessica, and we always have a lovely day there, and they always do it on that Tuesday of Remembrance Week, and obviously this time it happened to be Armistice Day, which was really great. We had a lovely time, and we all had a bit of a dance, didn't we?
Really?
I was quite surprised. We thought, there's a big dance floor here, we're going to try and get everybody up and dancing, and as soon as we said it, well, people didn't need an excuse. The floor was full.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
It's nice to get people dancing along.
It makes a real difference to us on stage as well. It gives us a lot of energy, you know, when we see people enjoying it and dancing, it makes a real difference. It's great.
Yes, so what kind of things have you been doing?
I've been quite busy babysitting, actually, because Emily's done rather a lot. Yeah. But my sister's in Kenilworth Grange Home. She's not very well, really. But she's my older sister. And Emily and I went along to sing to them. So that was quite nice. And that was Remembrance Area.
That was the day before.
Yes,
on Monday.
Because they asked Emily if she could do Armistice Day, but of course, obviously, the D-Day darlings are really busy on Armistice Day. So we went the day before. But while she was on her way to... That wasn't it, I think? You had a call from the headmistress?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So she had a call from the headmistress of the little girl that she's got at school. And said, could she come on Remembrance Day? Well, that was the 10th of November when she rang.
Yeah.
And of course, needless to say, Emily was
already
really busy.
Yeah, so I did go and do an assembly, but on the Friday, which was really nice, because it was just so nice for the children, you know. Their favourite song, absolutely without exception, is Run Rabbit Run.
Yes.
All the little kids love it.
Yes.
But Mum's got a very busy time coming up, because she's going to be performing in the Christmas shows at Coombe Abbey.
I'm busy with the carols with afternoon tea at Coombe Abbey, and some of the songs you heard today we'll be singing, and also new ones. Our mentor has a fixation, let's put it that way, with the John Lewis adverts, and the recent John Lewis advert is really difficult, and we've got to learn it.
So are you one of the medieval ladies?
No, the carols we do as a sort of
choir.
But you are
a medieval lady.
Yes, I am a medieval lady as well.
Well,
I do the banquets too. Yes,
excellent.
And shortly I'm going to be in Beauty and the Beast as a crony, whatever a crony is. Yes.
Actually, I think you're a tavern master crony, which means Mum's going to be one of the characters hanging around at the pub.
Yes. That sounds good. Yeah.
Sounds great. Thank you very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
This is London. The Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Winston Churchill.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and a Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and the airport in Europe. Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight, Tuesday, the 8th of May. Advance Britannia. Long live the cause of freedom.
Tomorrow.
That just about brings us to the end of this week's programme. So it's goodbye from the Outlook team and from me, Peter Walters.